good friends. Welcome on a Friday afternoon, end of the week. Time for the weekend, but we still have one more day of business here on INN World Report Radio. Welcome to the program, friends. My name is Tom Kiley. I'll be your host for the next hour. And we bring you INN World Report Radio right here from New York City, about half a mile or so north of Ground Zero on the west side of Lower Manhattan. INN World Report, we are an alternative media group here in New York City dedicated to bringing you, the listener and the viewer, because we also do television, news the networks won't tell you, real news the networks won't tell you, and once in a while they get it right, and when they do report on something that we are covering as well, you can bet that we'll bring it to you on from a different angle, one that they're not allowed to go for. Welcome to the show. We have a great show lined up for you. We've asked a guest to return with us here last Friday, if you were listening. We spoke with Doug Guthrie. Doug Guthrie is a professor at New York University, just not too far from here, and he's an expert on China. And if you've been listening to the program lately, you know, friends, that I'm trying to focus on the emergence of China on the world stage, or I should say reemergence of China. China was quite the world power, and as we learned from our guest last week, Doug Guthrie, about 400 years or so, excuse me, about 600 years ago, China withdrew from the world stage and became isolationist and left the world scene for the European powers, the emerging European powers, to take, and that's what happened. Now, after 600 years or so of relative hibernation, you might say, China is roaring back as a world power, and that is certainly going to shake up the game. So we need to understand that, I believe. So I'm hunting for guests to bring to you who can enlighten us on aspects of this new dynamic of China rising to back to a position of increasing prominence in the world. And so that's what we're going to do guest-wise today. The phone lines are open right now in the first segment. Give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. 866-582-9933. Toll-free call, 866-582-9933. Give me a ring. I will be happy to send you out a book if you do that, because I've gotten some very interesting books from Trine Day Publishing has contributed some books to INN World Report. It's a sort of a mutual thing. We're helping build our listenership by offering you books if you call in, enticing you to call. And at the same time, we get to tell you about these very, very interesting books. Many of the guests that we've had have been some of these publishers as well. So give me a ring. I've got three great books here. I've got Jaded Tasks from Wayne Madsen. I've got Dr. Mary's Monkey from Ed Haslam, who was on the program last week. And I also have The Oil Card from James R. Norman, who was on the program last week as well. And that's a very, very interesting book as far as China is concerned. It's James Norman's contention, and he's a writer, business writer that has been following oil for a great long time. He says a lot of interesting things in the book, but he one of his most fascinating claims, if you ask me, is that he says the price of oil has been manipulated for geopolitical reasons for decades. Back to when in the 80s, when the price was kept artificially low, it caused great damage to the Soviet Union and helped to bring them down. Now there is plenty of oil on the market, yet the price is very high. And the reason for that, he contends, is because China needs to import at this point half the oil that they use, and they are still rapidly growing. That number should increase dramatically. So he's claiming that the price is very high right now to harm the Chinese. What do you think? Give me a ring, and I'll be happy to send you one of these books. You can even pick which one you'd like. 866-582-9933. Be happy to hear from you. And what else? Okay, so I would also like to let you all know that to help serve you better, we've put up at INN World Report a page on Facebook for this program. We're just starting it out, so it's not quite so full yet, but you can be one of the first people to go there and sign up if you would like, and you can get more information about the program. You can communicate with me. You could forward questions to me, especially when I have the opportunity to announce for, guests in advance. Maybe there's a question you may want to ask or have me ask of the guests. I would be happy to consider all contributions. If you do so, if you'd like to do so, I should say, just go to Facebook and search for INN World Report Radio, INN World Report Radio, and you should go right to our Facebook page. I posted a fantastic interview on there. Hopefully you got a chance to hear it on Wednesday. Barry Zwicker was on the program, Canadian peace activist, very famous, and a good, I think, a righteous speaker as well. Barry has been on the 9/11 Truth Movement for years, and he has recently written a piece that was questioning why is it that the traditional lefty peace movement and alternative media and so forth and icons on the left have yet to embrace the 9/11 Truth Movement, which he contends, and I agree with him 100%, is at its core a peace movement itself. So a very, very interesting interview. You can find it up there on Facebook. So if you go there, you can listen to that. And more importantly, if you enjoy the program and if you enjoy these interviews that we do, we'll be posting more and more of them there, and it would be a good way for you to get your friends involved too, and they can check it out. And so anyhow, that's that. So give me a ring as well, 866-582-9933, and I'll be happy to talk with you here on the air, and you don't have to worry because we will keep your information private. You can speak with my producer when we're done, and I'll get your book out. Therefore, let's see. So then, what else? Continuing with China, you know, this is a situation that comes up every few years where we insist on supporting Taiwan. We're getting ready to do that yet again. The Chinese are getting very angry about it, very vocal about it. Obama is also getting ready to talk with the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and that's also a bone of contention continually for the Chinese. So these are the kinds of things we can also talk with Doug Guthrie about today. What else? You know, I've been doing a lot of reading in preparation for the show and so forth, and I had a great interview last night as well. By the way, friends, if you can't get enough of INN World Report Radio, and I can't say that I blame you if you can't. I know it's an attempt at humor there on a Friday afternoon. I'm feeling my oats, I guess. Anyhow, we also have an evening program that's on two nights a week on the Rule of Law Radio Network. So that is on from 6 until 8 p.m. Central Time. And that's kind of like our after-hours program. It's a two-hour show. Twice a night. It's a two-hour two-hour show. And we really get to let our hair down on that one. We had a great, great discussion about 9/11 last night on that program. I'll be happy to let you know about that. We'll be putting that information up on the Facebook page as well. Meanwhile, I believe Doug is there from Tennessee. Doug, how you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing well. I appreciate your latest lineup. And, you know, I didn't know about China and how they were powerful. And one of the things, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. Well, to the victor also goes the writing of history and the not writing about things that they don't want to cover. So I was not taught this in public school, believe it or not.
Well,
I didn't know anything about China power.
Well, you should, you know, you'll really enjoy then listening to our guest, Doug Guthrie. And you can go back into the archives on our show on GCN. You can listen to last Friday's program, too. He really said a whole bunch about China's history. Very, very
interesting. Yeah, I did. I did listen to last Friday. I was impressed by his knowledge, and I didn't know any of it. And I was real impressed by the day before I forgot the guy's name, but the oil card.
Yes, James Norman. As a matter of fact, you're entitled to a book if you'd like. That'd be the one I can send you out if you'd like.
I would love that book.
Excellent.
It fits in with what Lindsay Williams has been predicting, I should say reporting from what his elite contacts say, that the next 2 years will have $70 to $80 oil.
Unbelievable. We're going off the air, on break. So you hang on and give your information to my producer, Oatman, and he'll get it to me. I'll get you out a book. And call back real soon and go to the Facebook page, INN War Report Radio on Facebook. Thanks a lot, Jeff, and have a great weekend.
America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central. For 9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming, top-of-the-hour radio news briefs, and INN World Report Radio. News talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon-free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to INNWorldReport.net.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Good friends, excuse me, welcome back. And this is our Friday edition, kind of a end of the week show. And I hope you're in a good mood. I certainly am. I'm looking forward to the weekend and a longer weekend at that with the holiday coming up on Monday. In any case, we had such a fascinating discussion last Friday with Doug Guthrie from New York University. Doug, who teaches there at the Stern School of Business, an expert on China as well. And so, you know, it was one of these situations when you have a good, knowledgeable person on a subject that you need to know a lot of information on, sometimes you just start plowing through the questions and you don't get to everything you wanted to get to. So we asked Doug to join us, to rejoin us and come back. Welcome back to INN World Report, Doug.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as you probably just heard, the listeners apparently are also appreciating us going into this very important history and changing emerging dynamic with China, right? It's something that you must get a lot of questions about these days.
Yeah, it's definitely a time when we're all looking at China and sort of wondering what the relationship is really about. And sometimes the conversations go in the directions like ours did last week into deep history, and sometimes they go into much more contemporary topics, from Taiwan to Tibet to military buildup to economic strength. And so, it's definitely an array of issues that people are interested in.
Well, that's why I asked you back, because, you know, I'm a firm believer that you really need to have a good grounding and a context, you know, when you're taking on a big topic like that. And I thought you just did a great job. I know that I consider myself to be fairly knowledgeable about a lot of things. But when I can learn as much as I did last week from a guest, I definitely want to have him back. So why don't we sort of move into a more contemporary – there's so much there. I almost feel like we should go halfway between now and ancient China. But I think we need to talk about the contemporary issues, right? So
yeah.
There's so many of them out there. There's the Taiwan issue. There's the Tibet issue. There's the energy issue. There's the resources issue. There's all the money that we owe them issue. What do you think is the one, if you had a limited amount of time to speak with our audience, we should focus on, like, one, two, three?
So I know everybody, many people care about the Tibet issue, and I think that that's actually an issue that many people don't know the history of, and it's sort of worth talking about. I know that the Taiwan issue has been in the news lately, but I've got a little – not less patience for, but sort of less interest in the substance of that issue, because I think the American politicians have sort of put that on the agenda. But that issue has really sort of been decided between China and Taiwan. And, you know, I'm happy to talk about how that is, but it just seems like it's a lot less complex. But then I think the real third issue is probably just the real fundamental question of where China's economy is going, how powerful it is, what it means that they own so much of our debt, and that relationship, I think, really creates the basis for a real necessity of a relationship of interdependence in ways that I think people don't realize right now.
If I could just add in one point, if you want to talk about the economic side of things, we also got we just got a call from Doug in Oregon who wanted to know if we could talk about the price of gold going up in an effort to curtail China's growth. If you know anything about that.
Uh huh. Okay. Sure. So where do you want me to start?
Well, why don't we talk about the emerging economy and the economic aspect of it? You know, you teach at the Stern School of Business. A lot of people must be thinking about what's the deal with all this money that we owe China and how, you know, what's the fate of that? I see that China was just in the news talking about changing its policy toward the dollar, no?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's actually a really interesting time for us to be thinking about our relationship with China. We, for so long, have been the dominant economy, you know, since sort of the fall of Japan's number one economy position. And we've grown very used to that position. And we still obviously do have the largest economy in the world, and we, you know, our per capita GDP, we do quite well compared to other places. But I think it's really important to note that the world has sort of shifted in terms of its balance of power on these issues. China is not just some kind of, you know, lucky success story where they had a lot of cheap labor and could develop a, you know, fast cash economy based on that by becoming the factory for the world. They have had a fabulous run that has been very, very economically innovative in many ways. And I think that's what's in some ways underappreciated about China. But there has always been this tension between the United States and China, which for some people it's about military issues, for some people it's about human rights. But I promise you that for most people in Congress, no matter what they talk about, the issue is about economic containment and economic fear. And so, you know, here is China kind of emerging in this period. From 1989 to 1999, the U.S. held China out of the World Trade Organization. And that balance of power shifted after China got the deal that they did with the U.S. and the accession to the WTO in 2001. And then ever since then, they've been pretty aggressively buying our debt. And some people wonder why. What's going on there? And I actually think that the Chinese they're a very interesting country politically because they're very aggressive about this notion of creating economic interdependence in order to make political problems go away. So rather than this being a threat, I would say that this is much more about the Chinese leaders' kind of ability to create economic dependence so that they actually can at least behind closed doors, make very clear, like, look, we are partners. We are going to be partners. There's no way that, you know, that's going to go away. So we just all need to chill out and, you know, not wave the sabers around. Now, that, of course, doesn't always work, and I think whenever our economy is weak, we kind of bring out the possibility of waving the U.S. flag and claiming that China is the source of our economic woes, which I don't think it is. And then that's sort of the story that gets told.
Well, can I pose a question? Listening to you, somebody just emailed me an article today. I forget where it came from. I was reading it hastily before our show. But somebody made this comparison of the famous Chinese general who wrote the book about the art of war.
Yep.
And the article was about how many of these principles of his we are violating. And the first one was, you know, you don't fight unless you have to. Maybe that's got something to do with buying up a lot of debt. I think that's a great question. Why don't we go to that, though, on the other side of the break, because we're just ending this segment here. Folks, we're talking with Doug Guthrie from New York University. We got a loaded question for him. Stay tuned. Well, let's get the answer to it right after the break.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Thank you. right, good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley on a Friday edition of INN World Report Radio, coming to you from a snowy New York City. Hopefully it's a little warmer where you are, although I hear in the southeastern United States they're getting ready to be hit by a winter storm. Anyway, I hope you all fare well if that's the part of the country that you're in. Meanwhile, we've got a very hot conversation that we are continuing here about China with Professor Doug Guthrie from New York University's Stern School of Business. And before the break, we were talking, Doug, about the idea of, you know, the famous Chinese general who wrote the book on war, that the best way to win a war is without firing a shot or without having to fight one. Could that possibly be one of the theories behind why China is taking in so much of our debt while they're so flush with cash?
I mean, I think it's a very nice point, and it's a very nice analogy for what's going on. I don't know that the technocrats in Beijing are actually thinking that way or reading those concepts, but I think that the basic concept is really central to what they do. So during the Bush administration, you know, there would often be this sort of blustery, hawkish rhetoric about how China is building its military so aggressively. And frankly, it's just not true. I mean, China's military has always been set at about 8.1% of GDP. Of course, the Chinese economy has grown, so like the investment in military has grown. But just to put that in perspective, that's less than half of what the U.S. is in terms of percentage. And it's also, you know, about a tenth or maybe somewhere between a tenth and a twentieth of what the U.S. is in terms of absolute investment. And so China's strategy is not to be a military power. China's strategy is actually to create economic interdependence so that everybody is so dependent on them that they cannot, you know, you can't help but interact with them. And they did that very effectively with Taiwan. You know, Taiwan used to be a source of great tension, but after they relaxed the cross-strait relations and basically invited 500,000 wealthy Taiwanese factory owners into the southeastern seaboard of China, by the time the Democratic Progressive Party was elected in 2000 on Taiwan, Chen Shui-bian knew very clearly that he could never make a case for Taiwanese independence because he would lose half of his wealthiest citizenry. And so I think China has consistently done that, and I think buying our debt is really about that as well. I think that's what they, you know, again, they don't speak about this openly, but I'm sure behind closed doors they're like, yeah, the more interdependent we are, the better off we are because these guys need us.
I'd like to continue on the economy, but before we do, we got a question from a caller, Dan in Oregon, who wanted to know if you can speak to the notion that the price of gold is being kept up to particularly to curtail Chinese growth. Is there any do you know anything about that? I mean, I realize it may be a little bit of a tough question, but if you can even speak to it in general terms, I think it'd be interesting.
Sure. I mean, I don't know the specific article or expert site that the person is alluding to, but there is a general sentiment out there that investing in commodities, especially commodities that are you know, sort of pre-Bretton Woods were the sort of centerpiece of economic stability, allows for a much more stable set of investments that's independent of things like debt that China owns at the U.S. And so the idea that we would kind of push towards investment in gold and gold investment by propping up investments in gold, you kind of incentivize people to invest more and more in this commodity. It takes you away from the dynamics of global trade, if you will. And so I think that there's a lot of nervousness that in all of the world of kind of manufactured debt, you know, U.S. T-bills and all of the kind of debt-ridden products that have caused the global economic crisis, if you just get back to the basics of investing in gold, you'll create less dependence on the Chinese economy. I don't know how far we would want to go with conspiracy theories on this, but you know, I think that it really comes out of the notion that we're all, many people are very scared about China's growing economic power, and the extent to which it has great influence over the U.S. decision making.
How true would you say the following statement rings to you, that were it not for China scooping up so much of our debt, our economic woes, as bad as they are, would be far greater?
I would say that statement is 100% true. I think that many people forget that China is, you know, we just focus so much on the trade deficit, which I think is also sort of a red herring or a little bit of a false argument, but we focus so much on that with the notion that, you know, that's really the source of our economic woes, but we forget that China has really kept us out of a recession. I mean, China has been voraciously buying our debt for reasons that I was just naming. I think that they want to have this interdependence so that it makes us all on the same team. But that decision has really, it's underwritten our military decisions in the world. It has kept us much out of a much deeper recession than we would have been. And so I think that it behooves us all to remember that kind of dynamic.
And, you know, someday you're going to have to pay the piper, A, and B, I'm sure that's not lost on the people who need the credit here in this country to have a war and so forth. One wonders what kind of quid pro quos are even either happening or being considered as a result, when you're going to have to pay the piper for it. But I guess in another sense, China would have a vested interest just in keeping the ability of the American consumer to purchase their goods, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the latter is important, but I think the paying the piper is much more along. We've actually started to see that in the last year. So I thought the G20 meeting that happened in Britain in May, and then again in the fall, I guess in October in Pittsburgh, it was very clear that China was striking a very different pose than it's struck many different, you know, any other time in modern history. And that pose was, okay, we're not. You know, you guys can pretend you have this G7 club, but we are not second-class citizens at the table. We are first-class citizens, and we are right there with you, United States. And so I don't know if you remember, but during right before the G20 meeting in May, they released a statement that was basically saying we're kind of concerned with the fundamentals of the economic economy. And so of the U.S. Economic system. And so if you think about what that means, like here it is, the largest communist nation in the world, basically saying to the U.S., like, well, you guys maybe always thought you were the best in finance and the best in economic structuring of capitalism, but we're not so convinced, so we want to make sure you all understand what you're doing.
Well, on that note then, I was certainly alive when when Nixon went to China. I mean, was it Philip Glass, I think, even made an opera out of it or something?
Yeah.
That was a fundamental move, and, you know, it's, you know, like it would take a Democrat to go and reform welfare. It would take a Republican to go and make a deal with the communists.
Right.
Exactly. How much, I mean, did we really kickstart them with that, or were they on their way to pull themselves out of a long-term economic doldrum situation for them? That's the question I'd like to focus on with you when you come back. Folks, we're speaking with Doug Guthrie from New York University, Stern School of Business and China expert. Very interesting. We'll be back with him right after this.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
All right. right, good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio. And coming down the home stretch on a, not just a show, but a week. For our Friday program, we're very happy to have back with us Doug Guthrie from New York University, Stern School of Business. Knows an awful lot about China, and that's why we asked him on, because we need to inform ourselves about this emerging dynamic. I'm not counting on getting an education from the media about this. I'm not counting on our children getting an education about this in school. So we need to use this great technological advance, the internet, and the ability to create radio and television to inform ourselves. So while we still can, that's what we're going to do. And we're going to invite people like Doug on. Doug, I think right before the break I had asked a question. It's a question. Would we be facing this same situation were it not for I should say, if Kissinger didn't and Nixon didn't make their advances when they did, or would this probably have happened in any case because Deng Xiaoping was some kind of a closet capitalist, I think you said before. I think is a good way to put it. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't want to put too much credit on the U.S. I think it showed great foresight of Nixon and Kissinger to recognize that, like, we needed to have a relationship with the most populous nation of the world, and if this place ever did explode economically, it would be in our interest to do so. And it turned out that, you know, Mao died in 1976, and there was a power struggle. And in 1979, Deng Xiaoping came into power, and the first thing he did was, you know, he came to the U.S., he visited Jimmy Carter, he, you know, got a present of a cowboy hat and went to a John Denver concert and did all the cultural things that you do. But he was also very, very long-sighted about how to – so he also went to Seattle to visit Boeing. He went to Atlanta to visit Coca-Cola. He went to Houston to visit NASA. And with the new law that had just been passed under his watch on the joint venture law, Boeing and Coca-Cola become the first joint venture partners in the new joint venture law, and they also launch a new space program that launched a rocket about 2 years ago. And so you can sort of see how clearly this guy, Deng Xiaoping, was so he was so cogent about what he was thinking that China needed to do. They needed a consumer culture, they needed a high-tech culture, and they needed, you know, a technologically driven space culture to compete on the global economy. And so my guess is, like, he would have done that with or without the U.S., but he thought of the U.S. as a partner probably because Kissinger and Nixon had been to China nearly a decade earlier.
And let's not forget what was called at the time and for many years afterwards, the China card. I mean, just to piss off the Soviet Union, I think a guy like Kissinger would have done that anyway. And who knows? I think the Chinese probably were kind of, tinking glasses behind the scenes and saying, hey, isn't this fun, driving the Soviets crazy, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You're right.
Like, they called it the China card. It was
we were both countries were annoyed with the Soviet Union, and it made it very easy.
Okay, listen, there are a lot of topics I'd still like to get to, so I'm afraid we're going to have to ask you back again. But I'm really interested in talking about Tibet. The Dalai Lama's visit is coming up again. But you know what? I'm going to resist the urge, since we're talking about economic matters so much. Well, let's save that for another visit. How about the average Chinese? And as I understand it, we're talking about people that are not elites in the party. I guess there's a new class now also that are capitalist roaders, who own factories and stuff. But other than that, my understanding of the regular folks in China are that they're generally two kinds, people who live in the cities and people who live in a very grinding poverty out in the countryside. So what about am I missing any large group?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say that that's a pretty good estimation. I don't think it breaks down so clearly into urban and rural anymore, but there is the basic point I think that you're alluding to that's really important is that there are still, by the most stringent standards, the U.S. the World Bank standards on abject poverty, there are probably 500 million or more people living at that level in China. And that's obviously still a huge issue and problem. And then there is a group of people, probably 300 million strong, that are not living in abject poverty, but are still, you know, living at subsistence level. And then there's probably another, you know, 500 million who are emerging as middle class and nouveau riche and economic elite who do very well. And, you know, I mean, if you sort of think about that just as in population terms, you have, like, you know, four nations the size of the U.S. in that structure. And so there's a lot of people there, and there's a lot of inequality. The one thing that's interesting to me is I often get asked about this when I'm giving talks on China, and people sort of see it as an indictment on the Chinese government. How come they're not managing inequality? And I'm always a little confused by that question, because the problem of inequality is a problem of capitalism. And so, of course, you know, China has actually managed the inequality issue. I mean, it's still terrible in China, but they've managed it much more closely than any of the other countries that made this rapid transition to a private economy.
Well, hold on a second. That spurs a question. Are you meaning to say that in the past everybody was much more equally suffering in more difficult conditions, and that
yeah.
and what's happening now is they're trying to lift that population, although they're not doing it all at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, everybody was poor. I mean, but, you know, it bears noting that in Mao's China, people had pretty high levels of education for a very poor country, and they had pretty high levels of health care for a very poor country. But the interesting thing about capitalism, of course, is that capitalism is it can be a brutal system if you just let the market work its magic. And so, you know, there's a lot of countries that, like Russia and some others in the Soviet bloc, that have gone through rapid transitions to private property into a private economy, and people have suffered much more, and it hasn't changed the inequality equation. And so it is true that there's a tremendous amount of inequality in China, but, like, I think they've moved very aggressively at trying to, you know, lift the tide for as many people as possible.
And I'm not – there must be several motivations for that, but not the least of which is the fact that, you know, you can only get away with this for so long before people are going to get pretty mad at you, right? And,
right.
You know, and then – and not – you know, they feel like they've got nothing to lose. What's the famous Chinese expression? Heaven is high and the emperor is far away.
Right.
Is that a fear? Is that in the mind of the leadership in China?
I think absolutely they think about the discord and the sense of unrest in the countryside. I mean, frankly, it's part of the reason that, you know, China often doesn't get credit for doing anything in the way of political reforms, but the political reforms, the democratic reforms, have been most aggressive in the countryside. And so at the village level, they actually have true democratic elections. And the reason for that is because in the late 1980s and early 1980s, everybody was still so poor, and they were having real problems of corruption. And so the answer to it, ironically, or, you know, logically, if you think about it from U.S. terms, is that you need a democratic system in which people are held accountable, or they're going to lose their jobs as politicians. And so that's really what they put in place.
That's for the people in the countryside. That doesn't hold sway for the people at the top in Beijing, right? In the Forbidden City.
Right. Yeah. No, those are village level elections, which is still a large swath of the population, but it's not for national level politics.
Well, I think it's very interesting. I'm trying to think I guess. Well, no, you know what? We're running out of time. What I wanted to ask you about, maybe this will set the stage for another interview, is what about the fear, I think, that may be quite rational on the part of the leadership in China? The room for mischief in such a big population that's clamoring and hungry for change of, let's just say, a color revolution or a technological Twitter revolution, you know,
right.
That might be spurred on by external forces that wish to die. Is that a legitimate question?
I mean, I think it's a legitimate fear, and actually there is precedent for it being a fear. So people often talk about the discrimination against Falun Gong.
Right.
And the reason that Falun Gong became outlawed as a religion is because they used text messaging to organize a protest in Tiananmen Square.
Let's leave it at that, because we're right out of time, Doug, but we'll have you back on again to talk about this, because I told you...